"Americans have finally heard about Dresden," said Rumford, 23 years after the raid. "A lot of them know how much worse it was than Hiroshima, so I've got to put something about it in my book, from the official Air Force standpoint. It'll all be new."
"Why would they keep it a secret so long?" said Lily.
"For fear that a lot of bleeding hearts," said Rumford, "might not think it was such a wonderful thing to do."
It was now that Billy Pilgrim spoke up intelligently. "I was there," he said. It was difficult for Rumford to take Billy seriously, since Rumford had so long considered Billy a repulsive non-person who would be much better off dead. Now, with Billy speaking clearly and to the point, Rumford's ears wanted to treat the words as a foreign language that was not worth learning.
"What did he say?" said Rumford.
Lily had to serve as an interpreter. "He said he was there," she explained.
"He was where?"
"I don't know," said Lily. "Where were you?" she asked Billy.
"Dresden," said Billy.
"Dresden," Lily told Rumford.
"He's simply echoing things we say," said Rumford.
"Oh," said Lily.
"He's got echolalia now."
"Oh." Echolalia is a mental disease which makes people immediately repeat things that well people around them say. But Billy didn't really have it. Rumford simply insisted for his own comfort that Billy had it. Rumford was thinking in a military manner that an inconvenient person, one whose death he wished for very much, for practical reasons, was suffering from a repulsive disease. Rumford went on insisting for several hours that Billy had echolalia, told nurses and a doctor that Billy had echolalia now. Some experiments were performed on Billy. Doctors and nurses tried to get Billy to echo something, but Billy wouldn't make a sound for them.
"He isn't doing it now," said Rumford peevishly. "The minute you go away, he'll start doing it again."
Nobody took Rumford's diagnosis seriously. The staff thought Rumford was a hateful old man, conceited and cruel. He often said to them, in one way or another, that people who were weak deserved to die, whereas the staff, of course, was devoted to the idea that weak people should be helped as much as possible, that nobody should die. There, in the hospital, Billy was having an adventure very common among people without power in time of war. He was trying to prove to a willfully deaf and blind enemy that he was interesting to hear and see. He kept silent until the lights went out at night, and then, when there had been a long period of silence containing nothing to echo, he said to Rumford, "I was in Dresden when it was bombed. I was a prisoner of war." Rumford sighed impatiently.
"Word of honor," said Billy Pilgrim. "Do you believe me?"
"Must we talk about it now?" said Rumford.
He had heard. He didn't believe.
"We don't ever have to talk about it," said Billy. "I just want you to know. I was there." Nothing more was said about Dresden that night, and Billy closed his eyes, traveled in time to a May afternoon 2 days after the end of the Second World War in Europe. Billy and five other American prisoners were riding in a coffin-shaped green wagon, which they had found abandoned, complete with two horses, in a suburb of Dresden. Now they were being drawn by the clop, clop, clopping horses down narrow lanes which had been cleared through the moon-like ruins. They were going back to the slaughterhouse for souvenirs of the war. Billy was reminded of the sounds of milkmen's horses early in the morning in Ilium when he was a boy. Billy sat in the back of the jiggling coffin. His head was tilted back and his nostrils were flaring. He was happy. He was warm. There was food in the wagon and wine and a camera and a stamp collection and a stuffed owl and a mantle clock that ran on changes of barometric pressure. The Americans had gone into empty houses in the suburb where they had been imprisoned, and they had taken these and many other things. The owners, hearing that the Russians were coming, killing and robbing and raping and burning, had fled. But the Russians hadn't come yet, even 2 days after the war. It was peaceful in the ruins. Billy saw only one other person on the way to the slaughterhouse. It was an old man pushing a baby buggy. In the buggy were pots and cups and an umbrella frame and other things he had found. Billy stayed in the wagon when it reached the slaughterhouse, sunning himself. The others went looking for souvenirs. Later on in life, the Tralfamadorians would advise Billy to concentrate on the happy moments in his life and to ignore the unhappy ones, to stare only at pretty things as eternity failed to go by. If this sort of selectivity had been possible for Billy, he might have chosen as his happiest moment his sun-drenched snooze in the back of the wagon. Billy Pilgrim was armed as he snoozed. It was the first time he had been armed since basic training. His companions had insisted that he arm himself, since God only knew what sorts of killers might be in the burrows on the face of the moon. Wild dogs, packs of rats fattened on corpses, escaped maniacs and murderers, soldiers who would never quit killing until they themselves were killed. Billy had a tremendous cavalry pistol in his belt. It was a relic of World War I. It had a ring in its butt. It was loaded with bullets the size of robin's eggs. Billy had found it in the bedside table in a house. That was one of the things about the end of the war. Absolutely anybody who wanted a weapon could have one. They were lying all around. Billy had a saber, too. It was a Luftwaffe ceremonial saber. Its hilt was stamped with a screaming eagle. The eagle was carrying a swastika and looking down. Billy found it stuck into a telephone pole. He had pulled it out of the pole as the wagon went by. Now his snoozing became shallower as he heard a man and a woman speaking German in pitying tones. The speakers were commiserating with somebody lyrically. Before Billy opened his eyes, it seemed to him that the tones might have been those used by the Friends of Jesus when they took his ruined body down from his cross. So it goes. Billy opened his eyes. A middle-aged man and wife were crooning to the horses. They were noticing what the Americans had not noticed, that the horses' mouths were bleeding, gashed by the bits, that the horses' hooves were broken, so that every step meant agony, that the horses were insane with thirst. The Americans had treated their form of transportation as though it were no more sensitive than a six-cylinder Chevrolet. These two horse pitiers moved back along the wagon to where they could gaze in patronizing reproach at Billy Pilgrim, who was so long and weak, so ridiculous in his azure toga and silver shoes. They weren't afraid of him. They weren't afraid of anything. They were doctors, both obstetricians. They had been delivering babies until the hospitals were all burned down. Now they were picnicking near where their apartment used to be. The woman was softly beautiful, translucent from having eaten potatoes for so long. The man wore a business suit, necktie and all. Potatoes had made him gaunt. He was as tall as Billy, wore steel-rimmed trifocals. This couple, so involved with babies, had never reproduced themselves, though they could have. This was an interesting comment on the whole idea of reproduction. They had 9 languages between them. They tried Polish on Billy Pilgrim first, since he was dressed so clownishly, since the wretched Poles were the involuntary clowns of the Second World War. Billy asked them in English what it was they wanted, and they at once scolded him in English for the condition of the horses. They made Billy get out of the wagon and come look at the horses. When Billy saw the condition of his means of transportation, he burst into tears. He hadn't cried about anything else in the war.